Welcome to the Maxmoo podcast. This is Lindsay. I'm the founder of Maxmoo, a website that makes recommendations to theater beyond Broadway in New York City. We are mid-winter festival season here in New York, and it is a time when all of the best, coolest, and weirdest theater performers gather here to perform their shows. And on this episode, we talk about some of our favorite shows that we've seen that are part of the festivals, and also some of the more curious events we've attended. The festivals run through this weekend, January 18th and 19th, and some shows even have extended runs through next week. So we hope you will get out and see something and tell us on Facebook what you saw and what you thought of it. And enjoy the podcast episode. Thanks. I thought we should start the episode by correcting all the errors from the last episode.
Uh-oh. What did we do?
No, there's this one in particular.
Oh, no.
Which is that I had identified Lauren Worsham as the, quote, big blonde in A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
Oh,
that's not correct.
Oh, no.
She's the brunette.
Who's still awesome, though.
Also super awesome. But I spent the entire first song of the Sky Pony show that I went to see going, this woman is amazing, but I wonder when the lead singer's coming out. And now we've concluded errors, omissions, and apologies. We can get to introductions.
Okay, great.
Nicole.
Hi, this is Nicole. I blog about theater at Mildly Bitter's Musings and the Craptacular.
And I'm Jack. I write for Maxmoo.com, and I also work at the Public Theater in New York.
Great. And we should note that Jack is here in his personal capacity, not as representative of the public. His opinions are his own. And I'm Lindsay Behrens. I'm the founder of Maxmoo.com, a website that makes recommendations about New York City theater beyond Broadway. So today we wanted to start by talking about all of the shows we have seen that are part of the crazy New York City experimental theater festivals in January. Oof. And since we last got together a mere 12 days ago, between us, we have seen 25 shows.
We're very tired.
That's not a healthy rate of consumption.
No.
But that's also not a typical rate of consumption.
But it's symbolic of a festival season where lots of things are coming into town and you have a very limited amount of time to see the new work.
Yes, but if that continues, we'll have to stage an intervention.
Well, that was my last year. That was my 2013.
Luckily, so. These festivals are usually only a couple of weeks, so there's a cutoff. That's...
What if we had an entire episode that was an intervention?
I'm waiting for my intervention. After I saw like 175 shows last year, readings, concerts, shows. And that's, I mean, I don't even know mathematically how many weeks of the, I mean, that's just
It's like an average of like three a week.
At least.
Yeah, that's, I'm in the
I'm
same.
I'm somewhere in there too.
I'm in the same boat.
And I had a job.
Yeah.
And a side job. And
so we have problems. Welcome to the podcast.
In this week's theater therapy.
Oh, that's a great one. All right. So let's start by talking about shows that we have all three seen.
Okay.
Which is just one show, actually. Yeah. Tyson VLE.
Right. Yeah. Which, and the only reason I saw it is because Jack made me. He convinced me. Because of this podcast.
Jack, why don't you start by describing that show?
Okay, so last week on the podcast, I recommended a show that's playing at the Coil Festival, PS122's Coil 14 Festival, called Tyson vs. Ali, which is a show that by Reed Farrington that imagines what a title fight would look like between Mike Tyson and Muhammad Ali, two heavyweight boxers, two very famous boxers who never actually fought in the ring. And the way that they bring about this fantasy in Tyson versus Ali is by incorporating live boxing elements. There are four actors that rotate playing the two boxers in a ring that takes up the entire stage. There's also some monologue elements and dipping in and out of actual quotes from the two boxers. And then in addition to that, there's also live video element that are projected on screens behind the boxing ring and also on these handy-dandy mobile screens that are used very creatively throughout the performance. And as I said last week, it's as much about boxing and these two guys and what types of boxers Ali and Tyson were as much as it is about who these guys were as men and as cultural figures and how they were similar, how they were very different.
Did you like it?
I loved it. I left understanding that it's very much a work in progress. It's part of a festival.
I did not know that.
And it's, it's his first iteration. It's a technologically very heavy show, but I thought that all the elements that I just described were woven together so beautifully and so creatively. Some of the technology that was used in this show is so groundbreaking. There are moments when these mobile screens that I mentioned a second ago are actually placed in front of the live boxers that projecting archival footage of fights that Tyson Ali were in, and the actors behind the screens are actually move for move matching the boxers. It's just an incredible thing. And then what I didn't expect to like as much, which I actually loved, was sort of the asides where Tyson Ali talked directly to the audience about who they are, where they come from, sort of their outlook on life and on the sport. And I loved watching the ways in which these two guys, these two very distinct personalities, were polar opposites of each other, but also converged in certain ways. I just thought it was a really, really cool multimedia exploration of this idea. I thought it was furious. I thought it was, the boxing was incredible. I just thought it was a really cool experience. What did you guys think?
What did you think, Nicole?
Well, I didn't know it was a work in progress.
Are you calling it a work in progress?
I'm calling it a work in progress. It's not like labeled as a work in progress. I should make that clear.
Yeah.
What I mean is that it's very much, this is a show that I think needs to have a larger budget and a larger stage in order to
and
do
a dramaturg
trying to do. And a dramaturg. Okay, I will say that a couple of things that I sort of quibbled with were, unless you know a whole lot about boxing history and these two guys going in, there are times when you can get super lost. And there's just some narrative issues still at work there. But I think that this show, because of what it's trying to do, I would imagine they're ultimately trying to get something with a larger budget on a bigger stage. And at that point, maybe work out some of the narrative kinks. I mean, that's my hope and my assumption.
But. Yeah, I mean, as it stood, I looked at it more of a piece of art installation than theater, weirdly enough. Like, I had this more sort of filmic, visceral reaction to it, as if I was watching, you know, a semi-stage documentary rather than a piece of theater. Maybe because the narrative was a bit thin. And I thought the moments where the spliced together fight between Tyson and Ali was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was like transfixing and absolutely beautiful. And if I had seen that in a museum, like I had this moment of sort of Andy Warhol coming back to me in sort of the screen tests, the Andy Warhol screen tests. There was just something about that kind of taking found footage and using it, taking archival footage, putting it, juxtaposing these two pieces of archival footage and telling a different story. And that for me was fantastic. And I, you know, and I honestly loved hearing the voices of Tyson and Ali and what, you know, I'm assuming is just, I mean, I don't know. I don't know enough about their personal stories to know if they were direct quotes or if this was some sort of dramatization of those quotes, though I imagine they're such dramatic figures to begin with, they were likely their quotes.
From what I can tell, everything was, I mean, I recognized about 80% of those quotes just, you know, being relatively familiar with those two guys.
Right.
So.
But again, I guess I couldn't quite, it wasn't all coming together for me. And the individual screens that you were talking about that get inserted during the fights, from where I was sitting, I had a terrible, I don't know if it was a terrible angle or with the lighting, I couldn't actually see what was projected on the screen. Mm-hmm. So the identity of the boxers behind the screen started to get really very fuzzy. And there are four different actors rotating through. I mean, and the actors, I mean, there's no doubt the amount of athleticism that this production calls for is incredible. They are just boxing for the entire time. I mean, it's, and you know, and boxing is a very relentless, you know, marathon kind of sport. And so, you know, I give them credit for that, but I felt like a lot of times then I lost the identity of who was, I mean, obviously, you know, when it's Mike Tyson's voice, you know, when it's Ali's voice, they're very sort of distinct cadences, but their fighting styles are things that are, you know, also very specific and aren't things that I'm terribly familiar with. Right. So I started to lose that strand during some of the actual boxing.
Lindsay?
Yeah, I think we've covered this.
Okay.
I mean, it's all very good, but it needs work.
And I was surprised by the crowd. Like, it seemed to draw, like, a crowd of what I was guessing were boxing fans, not theater fans. Like, I don't know how to say
so
that
funny.
Politely.
So
that Venn diagram is fascinating, by the way. I'm one of them, and it's awesome.
I took a friend to the play, and he leaned over kind of in the beginning of it to me, and he said, "How many people here do you think this is their first boxing match?" And I wanted to say, well, this is my first boxing match, but my third play about boxing.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's a very New York thing to say.
So many boxing shows. God. It's just the worst.
You know, I prefer to live my life via a theatrical representation of life.
Well, I mean, and I love, like, I don't know if you love boxing. Have you read, like, Bud Schulberg's books because he wrote about boxing in the 40s and 50s, the guy who wrote On the Waterfront. Yeah. And his book, The Harder They Fall, is actually one of my favorite books of all time. So like, I really do love sort of boxing history.
Yeah.
And
really?
I do.
It's a fascinating thing. And actually in the show, there is a moment when there's a whole act where the four boxers sit around in the ring between fights and actually recount the history of boxing.
This sort that of is like an awesome
it's
moment.
It's like the baguettes of the Bible. It's from fist to fist who they were essentially historically in the ring with.
I thought that was a really beautiful
it's
moment.
Really cool.
Yeah.
And actually, I think it's one of those moments you're talking about the narrative issues and wondering where we were. That was one of the moments where I felt the show was really grounded in what it was trying to say.
Yes, I agree.
And it was, love it.
But it took three quarters of the play to get to that scene, which was fantastic, but, you know. Dramaturg. Just hire a dramaturg. It's good.
Sounds like okay. Sounds like we all pretty positively reacted to
that. I think so.
That's nice.
All right. I mean, I know we've talked about this before, but now we just saw it, so I think we should talk about it again. Kate Tempest. Brand new Ancients. Jack, have you seen it yet?
I have not seen it yet.
When are you
seeing
it?
I'm seeing it on Saturday.
So fucking good.
I can't wait. I would love to hear you guys talk about it, though.
Okay, let's not blow your expectations up, because I don't want you to be like, well, I thought it was going to change my life, and it was just actually kind of amazing.
I can take it.
I mean, it has renewed for me my love of theater after 175 shows last year that maybe kind of drained my love of theater out of me.
I completely agree.
It is so contemporary and yet so respectful and conscious of history and literature and where it comes from. It is creative and different and uses music in a really wonderful way. I mean, I had this interview with Kate for the Craptacular.
Which is great, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think didn't actually get into the interview on the website is that just how the music component came about and how she collaborated with Nell Catchpole and the musicians who are largely playing at St. Anne's Warehouse for this week, and each of their pieces and how they built the narrative and how she had a draft of Brand New Ancients and handed the draft to the musicians and they started sculpting a score and went back to her. And so backwards and forwards. And so, I mean, for me, seeing that work and seeing that end result is a really beautiful piece of collaboration. And I think we sometimes forget about how collaborative the theater works can be.
That's exciting.
She is just such a charismatic performer. And the way she delivers the spoken and then the rapped and then the sung parts, it's like it's tumbling from her and she couldn't prevent it from exiting her body if she tried to. It's like it has to happen. There's so much momentum in the way she delivers the words. I find it just, you cannot take your eyes off her for the entire performance.
It's like she's possessed by this story and it is going to take her over and come out because this is a story that has to be told.
Yeah.
Can you guys talk a little bit about what the show is? Because I actually don't
know. It's a hybrid of spoken word, poetry, rap, and then some performance that I would call singing, although I don't know if you would call it that. But I felt last night, actually, I really felt like there were times when she was singing. And then instrumental parts. And it's her and four musicians. And it's a story.
Yeah, it's a piece of storytelling about people in South London, about sort of what I think she is trying to get people to pay attention to or the people that no one pays attention to. Mm. Like, she wants you to walk out on the street and look around at your neighbors and realize everybody has a story.
Oh, man.
And, you know, in the sort of my love of Claudia Scheer, I mean, that's like a quote from Blown Sideways Through Life. I mean, everybody has a story that will break your heart. And I think what she does is she finds a group of characters. She finds essentially two generations, some parents and their children, and talks about their stories. And what I love is that she treats each of the characters with like the utmost respect. There isn't a lot of moralizing that she's doing, because I think that's what she's also trying to make us very conscious of, is how easy we are to dismiss somebody. Well, that guy is, you know, a criminal, so I'm never going to talk to him, but never sort of looking at like, how did he come to be? How did he get to that place?
That sounds great.
Yeah.
I want to see this show. I'm going to see it.
Yeah.
I like the idea of something that not only fosters the kind of enthusiasm you're talking about, but I also love, Lindsay, the way you describe it. I love anything that is described as, well, it's kind of like this, but not really. And there's a little bit of this other, but not really. You have to see it. I love when people say that to me. I have to go see that show, whatever it is.
Well, I think one of the things that is interesting about this show is the person who's delivering it, she is a young blonde woman.
Mm-hmm.
And
a little pixie, like you could fit her in her in your pocket, like yeah. She's a tiny little thing
rapping about London.
And
it just, and she looks much younger than she actually is.
Yes, she looks very young. And then this thing comes tumbling out of her that you can't imagine not coming out of her. And there, and yet it's so different from what your expectations would be if you just met her on the street.
Right. Well, and I think it's funny to think, like, I read a lot of interviews about her before I interviewed her, and just the idea that when she used to do rap battles, I mean, she's this tiny little wisp of a thing, and nobody would hand her the mic. She had to, like, convince guy friends of hers to get the mic handed to them, and then they would hand it to her, because wow. No one would think that, like, she wow. was, you know, she was a worthy competitor. And, I mean, Jesus, she is. Absolutely.
Hey, what should we talk about next?
I saw a bunch of festival stuff. I don't know if anybody else has seen anything that I've seen.
Well, I definitely want you to talk about the one at Japan Society.
Oh, man, which closes tonight.
Oh, shoot. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's called The Room Nobody Knows. It's playing at Japan Society as part of the Under the Radar Festival, which is basically public, but this is at Japan Society on 47th Street. And the guy who did it, I'm going to butcher his name because I don't speak Japanese, surprise, is Niwa Gekidan Panino. And it's this, it's a guy who is a sort of a very avant-garde theater artist, but who whose parents were both psychologists, and he himself was a psychologist. Ooh. Until very recently. So he has made this very dreamlike, deeply fucked up, deeply sexual piece about what it was like to grow up in that house. I don't want to say too much about it, although the chances you have to see it are limited, so I don't know if you want me to spoil things.
No, tell us about it, because all I've heard is everyone say, like, oh my God, what's going on at the Japan Society? That show is crazy. It's crazy. Totally nuts. It blows your mind. You yes. won't believe what you saw. And we're going to miss it.
So tell us.
I would
tell
check
what
all
missed.
Of those boxes you just mentioned. Yeah, it is exquisitely strange. The show is...
like Tim Burton strange or
no,
like Fassbender strange?
I would describe it as sort of a comic storytelling... with deeply disturbing elements and a lot of penises. And what I mean by this is that the story takes place, it's this two-tiered set. It's a story about two brothers, one of whom is studying for his college entrance exams, but can't because he's thinking about his brother coming home. And while he's preparing for his brother to come home for his brother's birthday, this guy has been, with the help of his two elven assistants, who may or may not be actually real, is carving lots of furniture, utensils, and other household objects in the shape of penises. And the story, I don't want to give too much away in case it comes back in any form, but there is some very sexual use of Pachelbel's canon, in which penis fifes are played to beautifully, I might add, to play.
I think you
Pachelbel's
lost me
canon.
At penis fife. I don't know.
That's where they got me. That's the funny. They got me a penis fife.
You're like completely enraptured at that moment.
There's mathematical riddles. There's an incestuous relationship between two brothers. There's goat creatures.
This doesn't sound very Japanese, actually.
It didn't.
It sounds a lot more like, I mean, having seen more Asian cinema than I've seen Asian theater.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of really interesting sort of quasi-sexualized stuff going on in Korea, so yeah. I'm fascinated.
I'm not that familiar with Japanese theater, so I can't really speak to that, but whatever it was, I don't know if it can be really pinned down to any part of the world, or even really any one part of the mind. It's just right, this crazy... Right.
He doesn't represent us, but Japan says.
There were some people...
supersedes state borders.
But I want to mention two things. With the audience I saw it with, this gives you a good idea of how people are responding to this show. When I walked out of the theater, there was a lovely young couple that left with me, and they walked past me, and as soon as they were halfway down the block, the girl hit her boyfriend and goes, "Why did you take me to that?" And the second person I want to talk about is the woman who was seated next to me during the show, who we all learned that evening, thinks that penises are the funniest thing in the world. And she was snorting with laughter the whole time. And I actually turned her afterward and said, I'm so glad you're here. This is so great. Anyway, it's hard to articulate what this show is, but it was really, really cool. Deeply, oh God, what to say? fascinating. Fascinating and unlike anything I've ever seen.
And we missed it.
Yeah.
We totally missed it. I do hope it comes back in some form, it sounds like it'll blow your mind, which
yeah,
is exactly what I'm looking
for. I can see all the poster pull quotes for this. They're all dirty. Yeah.
You were saying that theater posters needed more sex in them.
It's so true. It's true. I did actually tweet at the Irish rep about the fact that I feel like they continue to not put the really cute guys on their posters. Because, I mean, we need to know. If I knew there was a super cute guy singing and dancing at the Irish rep, maybe I would go see their shows.
I saw this funny tweet from the PR rep for Billy Budd that said something along the lines of, I have no idea what to do with this poster. There's no large-breasted woman to put on it.
Alas. Alas.
Jeez. Are you going to see that?
I want to.
I kind of want to also.
But I constantly like break up with Bam. So
constantly break up with Bam.
We get back together. It's a terrible relationship. We break up again.
You gotta go back.
I'm in the same boat, and I hate their website so much. Ugh. I'm like, just tell me what the show is, where it is, how to get tickets. Getting tickets on this website is a
freaking
puzzle.
There's so much fucking flash on their website. Stop it already!
I just want to see Franklin Jell, that's all.
No, don't. No. That's like a swear word for her.
Okay, then we won't talk
about
this right now.
Do not mention Langella A.
Do we want to mention any other festival shows? Or
I want to mention Sky Pony. And I even want to play a little song. Live music. It's amazing. Sky Pony's doing 4 shows at Here Art Center. I went to the first one, which was an acoustic set, and was so great. I'm going back to their show tonight.
Sweet.
Jella.
I know. They're also doing a show at Mercury Lounge in March.
Cool.
Okay. Any other festival shows we should talk about? Oh, The Record.
Okay. Which I have not seen. I was going to talk about another show. But if you want to talk about The Record.
So The Record is the show that Jack recommended by 600 Highwaymen that I thought sounded scary. It turns out it's not scary.
Confronting your fears, turning out they're smaller than you worried about.
I did receive assurances prior to attending that there was no audience interaction or touching of the audience, which is quite a relief because I walked into the theater and marched straight to the front row.
With confidence that you would not be bothered in any way.
With feigned confidence. Actually, sitting on the front row is a new thing for me, and I have you to thank for that because I really enjoyed sitting on the front row at the Kitson shows, and since then have adopted a greater interest in sitting on the front row so long as I know there's no audience interaction.
I think it helps because, I mean, for me, like when I go to concerts or anything like that, if you're in the front row, the rest of the audience just sort of drifts away.
It's just
largely.
It's like it's all happening just for you.
Right. It feels very intimate. It feels very personal. I'm also blind. So it's really helpful to be able to see what's going on. And I'm short, so it's hard. I don't have to like fight with other people's heads to try to look over them. Like for the unless the stage happens to be incredibly high, which happens to me every once in a while, like it's you know,
at a large theater, it's not always the best idea, but I really like it,
and I like to see the performers. I like to sort of be I don't want to be in their eyeline, but I want to be able to see them. You know, I want to see the nuances to their performance up close.
Well, I think most performers would say I can't see a thing in the audience. I've got bright lights in my eyes.
Although I was at a concert this week where one of the performers, he's like, I wore my glasses to look hip and cool, and now I can actually see you all, and it's a little disturbing.
Oh, wow. I never thought of that.
Although, yes, I mean, if you look at your watch during a Kitson show, he'll be like, do you need to get somewhere?
He can see you. Which is awesome. His x-ray vision.
So but The Record.
The Record is people doing movements. There's no words. There is sometimes music, but not always. And I'm sitting there watching it, and all of a sudden I have this feeling that like my whole body is tingly feeling, you know, like I'm really feeling something. But I'm also extremely conscious of the fact that I have no idea why I'm feeling that because there's no narrative.
Right.
I'm just watching 7 or so people on stage basically strike a pose. And yet I'm having this like incredibly emotional response to it. And I have no idea why.
You don't have to know.
No, I guess that's the group hallucination part. But the other thing is that I found really interesting is I kept trying to create a narrative for the movement in my head. And I knew going in that there's no story, but I'm like, oh, that woman's wearing a green outfit. She must represent the earth. And that lady has a dress on with flowers. They must represent the environmental movement. I'm like, no, that's not actually what's happening here.
Funny how the brain does that, though.
And then there's this one part where this woman's falling over and this guy's like holding out his hand. She's like slowly falling over and this guy's holding out his hand. And all I could think was, I think that's the failure of the welfare state.
And we bring ourselves to these shows.
Afterwards, I ran into somebody in the lobby and we were having this conversation. And I said, the funny thing about that show was that I kept trying to create a narrative in my head. And he's like, I know, that's exactly what I kept trying to do. And you're like trying to stomp down the narrative in your head and just appreciate the visual image that you're seeing. But you can't do it.
We're too programmed. We're too human.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotta find those stories.
It was really fascinating. And there was a cello in it. In 3 days, I saw three shows and there were three cellos.
That sounds great.
It's the year of the cello.
Year of the cello.
Yeah.
Okay, Jack, what else did you want to talk about?
Just one other under the radar show, since that's where I've spent the last week, pretty much, is a show from Chile by an artist named Lola Arias called El Año Que Nací, or The Year I Was Born. And it is about a half dozen actors at La Mama, not at the Public, in their sort of cavernous space in the Ellen Stewart Theater, telling the story of the rise and fall of Pinochet. But they don't do it through just sort of a narrative that you'd expect. They actually do it by telling the stories of their parents, the real stories of who their parents were at the time of the rise and during the fall. And in order to tell these stories, they monologue. There's a lot of visual elements. There's a lot of photographs that are projected and then drawn on to make extra points. There's dance. There are, at one point, a bunch of electric guitars. And then there's group discussion, some of which appears to be improv. I don't think it is, but it's meant to give off that impression. Anyway, I just felt it was a really special piece because it was such an interesting way of having a story told, not just through multiple narrators, but from multiple perspectives in the same place at the same time. And you realize, you know, especially with the rise and fall of dictatorships, we tend to create these sort of very linear narratives about how they happen.
Unified stories
about this is how it happened, almost, you know, like a fairy tale or a nightmare. And in this one, the actors all come from incredibly different perspectives. They all, some of them, their parents were outside of Chile at the time when Pinochet was doing his absolute worst. And some of them were in there, and they're people who had their parents killed by the regime. Parents who supported the regime, who fought against the regime. Anyway, it was just this incredible just melting pot of stories about one specific thing that never really amounted to a single narrative, but you felt like they were all together telling the same story. I just thought it was a remarkable achievement. And that is still running at the End of the Radar Festival, if you can catch it. It's really, really cool.
And is it in Spanish with subtitles?
Yeah, Spanish with subtitles. I should also mention that the room nobody knows at Japan Society is in Japanese with supertitles as well. So although there is some English used in The Year I Was Born, and it's used to tremendously powerful effect, I will say. And it's the only tease I'll give about the language.
Wow.
Yeah, super cool.
I wrote my thesis in college on Pinochet.
So you got to see the show.
Why aren't you seeing the show? This should be like top of the list.
If you Google me, you'll find a document called Collective Action and the Overthrow of Pinochet.
So what I'm learning is that Lola Arias wrote this show for you, is what I'm understanding right now. This is incredible, Lindsay. You gotta go.
It launched my life of collective action. Wow. Then I became a union organizer.
Wow. I wrote about the Japanese-American internments in America.
Oh, that's interesting.
So if anyone makes a theater piece about that, definitely let me know.
I'm sure that... Well, George Takei has a theater piece about that coming. Supposedly, they're trying to get it on Broadway.
What?
Oh, you haven't heard about this?
Nope.
Yeah, he has a play that he wrote about his family's experience.
Yeah.
And apparently, it's quite good, and I know that he was trying to get it on Broadway.
Was it out at some of the California theaters?
Yeah, I don't remember which theater.
Or somewhere. Okay.
Yep, yeah.
I might be wrong, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. On my list, then.
Super.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Max Moo podcast. Additional information about all of the shows we discussed is at maxmoo.com. Just click on podcasts. And we included a link to the Sky Pony song on iTunes. You can find all of us on Twitter. Max Moo is at M-A-X-A-M-O-O. Nicole is at Mildly Bitter. That's M-I-L-D-L-Y-B-I-T-T-E-R. Jack is at Jack in Brooklyn. That's J-A-C-K-I-N-B-R-O-O-K-L-Y-N. And I'm at Lindsay Behrens. L-I-N-D-S-A-Y-B-A-R-E-N-Z. See you next week.